This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Spiritual Ground of Education. This is the last lecture, Lecture 9 in the cycle, given in Manchester College, Oxford in 1922 in August. Lecture 9 is entitled Teachers in the Waldorf School, given on August 25th, 1922. Yesterday I alluded to the events that take place when boys and girls reach puberty, at 14 or 15. At this stage, the teachers who are serious about their responsibilities will face numerous difficulties. Such difficulties are especially obvious in a school or college in which education is derived from human nature. Overcoming these difficulties by extraneous discipline is not an option, because if they are repressed now, they will merely reappear later on in life in all sort of other forms. It is far better to face these problems squarely, as inherent to human nature, and deal with them. In a Waldorf school where boys and girls are educated together and keep constant company with one another, these difficulties occur frequently. We have already spoken of the difference between boys and girls, and this begins to appear around the 10th year. Girls at this age begin to grow more quickly, especially in height. Boys' growth is delayed until around puberty, and then boys catch up with the girls. This fact is very significant for those who observe the fine interplay of spirit, soul, and body from the standpoint of true human knowledge. Growth, which means overcoming Earth's gravity, engages one's essential being, whereas one is not really concerned about whether a certain organic phenomenon appears at one stage or another in life. In fact, there are certain cosmic, suprasensory influences that work on human beings from the external world, and these affect the female organization more intensely between the 10th and 12th years than they do the male organism. In a sense, females during this time even physically partake of the suprasensory world. Please realize the significance of this. Between perhaps the 10th and 14th years, the female organization begins to live more in a spiritual element. It is permeated by spirit at this time, and this affects the blood processes of girls in a very special way. During this time, the blood circulation is, in a sense, in contact with the whole universe. Its time must come from the universe and be regulated by it. If we were to perform experiments to determine the relationship between the rhythms of blood and breathing during this period of growth, even using physical instruments, we would find this relationship stronger among girls than boys. Boys of 13 or 14 begin to show a nature thus far hidden. They also begin to grow more quickly than do girls, and they grow in all directions, making up for the delayed growth. At the same time, boys' relationship to the outer world is quite different than it was during earlier periods of life. And so in boys, it is now the nervous system that is affected rather than the blood circulation. Thus it can easily happen that a boy's nervous system gets overtaxed if school instruction is not given in the right way. For during these years, the form and meaning of the language or languages he has learned have an enormous influence. The human ideas enshrined in language, whether his first or second language, press in upon and beset him, as it were, as his body grows more delicate. Thus, within boys at this age, the whole world drones and surges. That is the world of their earthly environment. In girls, a year or two earlier, something of the surrounding universe is planted in them. In boys, the earthly environment is planted in them through the medium of language. This is obvious externally in a boy's change of voice. And indirectly connected with this vocal transformation, enormously important events take place in a boy's whole organism. In the female organism, the voice is rounded off in a very slight way. On the other hand, connected with the girl's quickened growth, or a preparation has taken place in the organism, involving the flow of heavenly realms into the young woman. Recent advances in materialistic science are confirmed by a spiritual view. You see, when people hear that spiritual views or values are confirmed, they are likely to say, those oddball cranks dismiss everything earthly and material. And then a natural scientist comes along and cites the marvelous advances of purely material science in recent centuries. And so people believe that anyone who advocates something so alien as spiritual science is unconcerned with material things or practical life. And I am not saying that anthroposophy is alien to the world, but that the world is alien to anthroposophy. But it is precisely spiritual science that takes up the latest discoveries of the natural sciences with immense love and saturates them with knowledge from the spiritual world. Consequently, it is precisely among those who support spiritual philosophy that there is a true appreciation of materialism. A spiritualist can afford to be a materialist, but a pure materialist lacks knowledge of matter by having lost the spirit. Only the outer appearance of matter can be observed. It is the materialist who lacks real insight into material processes. I point this out because it seems very significant to me. Consider a Waldorf teacher's attitude toward children. Here you have a very different perspective of children who have reached puberty, children who have just passed through a stage of development that includes the organic changes I spoke of earlier. They see these in a different way than do those who know nothing of this from the spiritual point of view. A boy of 14 or 15 echoes the surrounding world in his being. That is, words and their meaning are taken unconsciously into his nervous system, and they echo in his nerves. The boy doesn't know what to do with himself. Something enters him and begins to feel foreign at this age. He is confused by himself and feels irresponsible. Those who understand human nature know very well that this two-legged being of earth called Anthropos is never, not even to a philosopher, a greater mystery than to a 15-year-old boy. At this age, all the human soul forces are beset by mystery. In a boy of 15 or 16, human volition, the capacity most remote from normal consciousness, begins to assault the nervous system. It is different for girls, but we should aim at equal treatment and recognition for both sexes, which must come in the future. Nevertheless, it is all the more important to distinguish clearly between the sexes. Whereas, for a boy, his self becomes a perplexing problem, for girls at this age, the problem is the world around them. Girls take into themselves something other than earth. A girl's whole nature develops unconsciously within her. A girl of 14 or 15 is a being who faces the world with a sense of amazement, finding it full of problems. She is, above all, a being who looks to the world for ideals to live by. Thus, much in the outer world becomes enigmatic to girls at this age. To a boy, the inner world presents many enigmas. To a girl, it is the outer world. We must understand and feel that we are now dealing with very new children. They are not the same children we had before. In some cases, the change arrives remarkably fast, and teachers who are not alive to the transformation may not perceive that they are suddenly confronted by a whole new person. This is why a most essential aspect in Waldorf teacher training involves receptivity to changes in human nature, and the teachers have acquired this relatively quickly, for reasons I will explain. A Waldorf teacher must be prepared to face something that will be completely different tomorrow from what it was yesterday. This is the true secret of teacher training. For example, in the evening, we usually think that tomorrow the sun will rise and things will be pretty much the same as they were today. Now, to use a somewhat extreme notion to express my meaning, Waldorf teachers must be prepared for tomorrow, whether the sun rises or not. Unless our view of human nature is as fresh as this, without preconceptions from the past, we cannot comprehend human growth and development. We may rest assured that changes out in the cosmos will be somewhat conservative, but when it comes to transitions in human nature, from early childhood to the teens, then, ladies and gentlemen, the sun that rose before may not come up again. In this human microcosm, Anthropos, such a great change occurs that we face an entirely new situation. It's as though nature one day confronts us with a world of darkness in which our eyes have become useless. We need open minds, ready to receive new wisdom each day, and a disposition that can transform accumulated knowledge into a sense of potential that leaves the mind clear for the new. This keeps people healthy, fresh, and active. A heart that is open to changes in life, its unexpected and continuous freshness, must be a Waldorf teacher's basic mood and nature. This change significantly affects the relationship between boys and girls at this age and their teachers. This was demonstrated last year by an episode at the school. One day I was back again at the Waldorf school to direct the education there, something I can do only occasionally, and a girl in the top class came to me between lessons. I would say that her mood was one of suppressed aggression. She was very emotional, but with extraordinary inner determination she said to me, "May we speak to you today? It is very urgent. The whole class would like to speak with you today, but only if you wish it." You see, she had made herself class leader and wanted to speak with me in the presence of the whole class. What was her reason? The boys and girls had begun to feel that they had lost touch with the teachers. They found it difficult to connect with the teachers in the right way. This was not caused by any hard feelings toward the teachers. There is no grudge among the children against the teachers of the school. On the contrary, during the short time the school has existed, they have come to love their teachers. But these children of 15 and 16 were now terribly afraid that they might lose this love because of the new relationship that had arisen between the students and teachers. They had an extraordinary fear of this. I did not snub them and put them in their places, as might have been done in the past if children blurted out this sort of thing. Rather, I went to meet and speak to the children. At this age, of course, one should call them young ladies and gentlemen, as I said before. I spoke to them in a way that made them realize I was prepared, then and there, to discuss the matter and reach a conclusion with them. I said, "We can discuss this together without restraint, and resolve it once we discover the problem." Then what I have just described came out. Tremendous anxiety over the possibility of being unable to love the teachers as they had before. Enormous wonder and curiosity about certain worldly matters had entered the children. And since Waldorf pedagogy is evolved day by day, each event must be studied carefully, with educational measures based on living experience. The children said much that had little to do with the issue, but it seemed immensely important to them, and they felt it deeply. Then I said a good many things to them about how we discover this or that in life as time goes on, and the children eagerly agreed. It turned out that all we needed was to rearrange the teacher slightly for the following school year. At the beginning of the following school year, I assigned language teaching to a different teacher. I just shuffled the teachers a bit. Further, we realized in the College of Teachers that this was the method we should use throughout the school, that we should make decisions by working with the students. But before one could accept this new situation, that is, meeting with young ladies and gentlemen of this age on equal terms, whereas one was previously an authority, it is essential to have what the Waldorf teachers have, an open world view. In German we call this a Weltanschauung, an ideology. One does not merely train in a teaching method. We must also have our own ideas concerning the destiny of humanity, the significance of historical epochs, the meaning of present life, and so on. These questions must not buzz around in one's head, but remain in one's heart. Then one will have a heartfelt experience of these matters while in the company of children. During the past 400 or 500 years of Western civilization, we have entered deeply into intellectualism. This, however, is unnoticed by the majority of people. Intellectualism, however, is naturally suited only to older people, whereas children are naturally averse to this mindset. Nevertheless, all modern thinking is tinged with intellectualism. Thus far, the only people who have not yet become intellectual are those over in Asia and in Russia, as far as Moscow. West of Moscow and as far as America, intellectualism is universal. We remain unaware of this. But to the degree that we belong to the so-called cultured classes, we think in a kind of mental language that children cannot understand. This accounts for today's chasm between adults and children. This chasm must be filled by teachers such as we have in a Waldorf school. This can be done only when we are able to see deeply into human nature. Allow me to say something of a physiological nature, something not usually considered. It can be correctly appreciated only when we encounter it as a fact of spiritual science. People believe it is a great accomplishment when something is formed as a concept. But only those who assess everything in their heads believe this, and truths are often very contradictory. If we go into the unconscious and our feeling nature, we find that all ideas, even those of philosophers, are connected to a slight feeling of antipathy. There is something distasteful in the formulation of ideas, whether we are aware of it or not. Thus it is enormously important not to accentuate this subconscious distaste in children by giving them too many concepts and ideas. This arises from the fact that when someone has been thinking very hard, the inside of the brain presents a strange formation. Unfortunately, I can give you only the facts on this, since it would take many lectures to demonstrate how it works physiologically. The brain is permeated by deposits of phosphorus compounds, deposited in the process of thinking. This is especially true when thinking one's own thoughts. The brain becomes filled with unreason, pardon the word. It fills with deposited products, such as phosphoric acid compounds, which litter the brain. These excretions are removed from the organism only when we sleep or relax. Consequently, the process that accompanies thought is not one of growth or digestion. It is a catabolic process that breaks down substances. When I follow a train of thought of someone who is somewhat mature, say over 16 years old, I set up a catabolic process that leaves deposits. It is this elimination of substance that provides the foundation for self-awareness. Now, if I simply dictate ideas, on the other hand, by stating finite concepts that have been formulated dogmatically, I put a person into a peculiar state. Finite concepts cannot take hold in human nature. They jostle and press one another and find no entry to the brain. Instead, they beat against the brain and cause it to use up old deposited substances through its nerve activity. The effect of finite intellectual concepts is to compel us to recycle the discarded substances that lie about within us. This gives us a feeling of slight distaste, which remains unconscious as it influences our disposition all the more. You see, unless we recognize these facts, we cannot appreciate their importance. People do not realize that thinking breaks down substance, or that thinking in mere ideas forces us to reuse what we have thrown off. We rehash the cast-off phosphoric acid salts. This is extremely important when applied to moral education. If we give children definite precepts as concepts, we cause them to approach morality in terms of ideas, and thus antipathy arises. The inner human organism rebels against and fights abstract moral precepts or commandments. On the other hand, I can encourage children to form their own moral feelings directly from life and from example, and this leads them to the catabolic stage. We get them to formulate moral principles as free, autonomous human beings. In this way, I help children toward an activity that benefits their entire being. If I merely give children moral precepts, I make morality distasteful to them, and this plays an important role in modern society. It's difficult to imagine the degree of disgust people feel toward some of the most beautiful and noblest of human moral impulses simply because they were given in the form of precepts and intellectual ideas. Waldorf teachers learn these things through spiritual science. Indeed, it is this that gives them insight into such material processes. Let me say it again. Materialism assumes the appropriate place in life only when we view it from the standpoint of spirit. This provides an understanding of what really takes place in the human being. Only by adopting a spiritual standpoint can we become truly practical educators in the physical world. But this is possible only when teachers themselves have a philosophy of life, when their view of the world causes them to feel the deep meaning of the question of the universe and human destiny. Again, I must make an abstract statement, but really it is very concrete. It only seems abstract. You see, as human beings, we confront the mystery of the universe, and we look for a solution to our questions. People today, however, assume that the solution to this mystery can be written out in a book and expressed in the form of ideas. Keep in mind, however, that there are those, and I have met a few, who have an extreme fear of a solution to the mystery of the universe. They claim that if such a solution were discovered and written in a book, what in the world would those who come after them have to do? They would be extremely bored. All the elements of a solution are available and need only to be understood. People think this would be truly boring, and I don't really blame them. The world really would be a boring place if someone wrote a book containing the answer to the mystery of the universe once and for all. We could simply read the book, and then what would in fact remain for us to do in this world? But we do not understand the human being as we should. We must start at the beginning, and humankind is an answer that takes us back to the beginning. And we must come to know this answer to our question, the human being, this Oedipus. And this causes us to re-experience the mystery of our own inner self. Every new human being is a fresh problem to be understood. You see, there must be something in existence that, once we have the key, calls us to greater effort toward a so-called solution. The mystery of the universe should not be stated as something to be solved once and for all. Instead, the solution should give us the energy to make a fresh start. And if universal questions are understood correctly, this is what happens. The world presents us with many questions, so many, in fact, that we cannot even perceive them all. By, in quotes, questions, I do not only mean those matters for which there are abstract answers. I mean questions about what we will do, the actions that result from our volition and feelings, and about all the many details of life. This is what I mean when I say the world presents us with numerous questions. So what is the real answer to these myriad questions? It is really the human being. The world is full of mysteries, and people confront them. Human beings are a synthesis and a summary, and the answer to the mystery of the universe comes from the human being. If one wants to become a Waldorf teacher, it means working from a true philosophy of life. And this mysterious relationship between the human being and the cosmos must become an unconscious wisdom of one's feelings. People today become alarmed if someone says that Waldorf teachers begin with spiritual science, which gives them their vision. What if this anthroposophy is imperfect? This is possible. So why not produce philosophies you think are better? A philosophy is needed for those who must work with human beings as an artist, and this is what teaching involves. When I look back over these 9 lectures, I find much to criticize as imperfect. But my greatest regret is that I gave them in the form I did. I would have much preferred not to give these lectures at all, as contradictory as this may sound. These lectures have been too much in keeping with the spirit of the time, for it seems to me that there is an incredible amount of discussion about the nature of education in our age, far too much. People seem far too driven to discuss the issue of how we should educate. And when we have to go into these questions ourselves, though from a different view, one realizes how it is all just too much. But why is there so much talk about education today? Almost every little town you come to announces lectures on how to educate. How does it come about that there is so much discussion and so many conferences and talks everywhere on this subject? If we look back to earlier ages of human history, we do not find that people talked nearly so much about education. It was something people did innocently, by instinct, and they knew what they were doing. I have said that a truly healthy education must be based on a knowledge of the human being, and that the staff of the Waldorf School must acquire this knowledge in the way I have described. So it is worth asking how those of earlier ages understood the human being so much better than we do. As strange as it may seem, we can answer that the people of previous ages were not as enlightened as we are in the area of natural science. But in their own way, they knew more about the human being than we do. I mentioned before in these lectures that humankind has gradually come to be considered a final product. We look at all the other creatures in the world and claim that they evolved up to the human being, the final product. And this is where we stop, having very little to say about the actual human being. Modern physiology even tries to explain the human being by experimenting on animals. We have lost the ability to give humankind as such a real place in the world. To a large extent, we have lost the human as a being. Spiritual science tries to reclaim knowledge of the world that does not exclude the human being. Such knowledge does not view the human being as merely the latest organism. With this knowledge of the world, one gains the power to see into the real nature of the human being as soul, body, and spirit. Further, one is able to comprehend what spirit actually does in the human being, and how the intellectual form of spirit breaks down substances, as I described. Our current way of viewing history does not achieve this. It halts with the human being, who is lumped together with animals. A biology is formulated, and this is connected with physiology, but there is no grasp of what the human being really is. As a result, people today act a great deal out of instinct, but as an object of scientific knowledge, the human being is not viewed favorably. Teachers require a science that will once again enable them to love the human being, because they can first love their own knowing. There is much wisdom behind the fact that people of ancient times did not simply speak about acquiring knowledge. They spoke of philosophia, a love of wisdom. Anthropos sophia, anthroposophy, would have human beings once again acquire wisdom that leads to a knowledge of the human being. When all knowledge and science centers on the human being, then we can answer educational questions through every aspect of our philosophy. All the knowledge we need, even about children, can be found everywhere. This is what we need. Because ordinary science tells us nothing about education, we create extra institutions and talk too much about education. Lectures such as these will achieve their object only when they have become superfluous. That is, when there is no longer any need to treat them as a special theme, when we once again possess a worldview in which education is implicit, when teachers have this knowledge and possess the art of education that they can exercise spontaneously. Our need to talk so much about education shows how little the rest of our knowledge involves an impulse for education. We need a complete change of direction. This is the real reason why Waldorf teachers do not cultivate a special pedagogy, but cultivate a philosophy of life. By teaching them to understand the human being, it is possible for them to be spontaneous and naive again in education. And this explains why, when speaking of Waldorf teachers, we must speak of the whole human being. This also eliminates the possibility of being fanatical about a Waldorf education. Fanaticism, which is so rife among people today, is ruled out here. Fanaticism is the worst thing in the world, especially in education. It causes people to push ahead in one direction, regardless of anything but a single goal reduced to precise slogans. If, however, we look at the world without preconceptions, we will agree that views and opinions are no more than views and opinions. If I photograph a tree, I have one view of it. This view shows a definite form, but the view is different from somewhere else, and different again from over another place. You might even think it was not the same tree if you had only the pictures to judge by. Likewise, there are various points of view in the world, each regarding only one aspect. If you know that things must be seen from manifold positions, you can avoid fanaticism and live in universality. Ladies and gentlemen, you will find goodness everywhere by simply realizing that most of what people say is not wrong, but lopsided. One merely needs to consider the other view and see the other side. Consequently, it is so strange if one is talking about Waldorf education and someone says, of course, we do this, but so-and-so does it all wrong. And then so-and-so says, we do this, but they do it very poorly. A Waldorf teacher would say they have their good points and so-and-so also has good points. We try to use what we find to be universal. This is why we often hear Waldorf education says the same things we say. This is not so, however. Rather, we say things that others can then agree with, because we understand that a fanatical pursuit of one line works the greatest damage. It is essential for Waldorf teachers to be free of all fanaticism and confront only the reality of the growing child. It is true that many people may claim to have encountered many fanatics in the anthroposophic movement, but if they look at things more closely, they will find that the goal of spiritual science is to make knowledge universal and to spiritualize it. It is a matter of indifference that it is called anthroposophy, as I explained. In fact, its only object is to universalize what has become lopsided. If people have found fanaticism and dogmatism within the anthroposophic movement, this came from outside. It is not inherent in the movement. Much is carried into the movement that does not accord with its nature and being. Consequently, when someone says that there is some sort of cult behind Waldorf education, one in which people indulge all kinds of crazes, that individual should study the matter properly and discover what it is a Waldorf school lives by. Then one will see that spiritual science can indeed give life to education, and that far from pursuing anything outlandish or falsely idealistic, it wishes only to realize the human ideal in living human beings. I will close these lectures by saying that the life speaking through Waldorf teachers arises from this source. Let me add that although I said that I regretted the need to give these lectures, it has nevertheless been a great joy to me to give them. I thank this honorable audience for the attention and interest you have shown. The end of Lecture 9 and the end of the book, The Spiritual Ground of Education by Rudolf Steiner.